Let's hit it. Hootie Hoot Productions presents the Sports Deli Podcast, where everyone deserves a seat at the table, where we discuss the intersection between race and sports, mental health, leadership, and equality. To find out more about the Sports Deli Podcast, check us out online at thesportsdelipodcast.com. We are starting to have free giveaways. If you hear giveaway anywhere in the podcast, send us an email to thesportsdeli@gmail.com with giveaway in the subject heading, and in the body of the email, give us the answer to that podcast's specific question.
Stephen A. Smith is my alter ego. Go somewhere else with that shit.
John, she's roasting your ass right from the jump. We ain't done the intro yet. What the fuck?
To me, Colin Kaepernick is a hero.
And Colin Kaepernick is going to go down as a legend. That when George Floyd called out to his mother, he called out to all mothers. And I heard his call.
So do you have white privilege?
Absolutely.
I think there's a balance between the idea of universal white privilege and it doesn't exist.
That now we have to be a voice as white people.
About it, African-American women last year changed the course of this nation. Women are the backbone, and now we need to support the souls that they stand on.
And now, whether you're folding laundry, driving, exercising, or cooking, grab your favorite deli sandwich or bagel and your favorite beverage, and let's do this together in the Sports Deli. Auntie, take us away. We're so honored on this 22nd day of International Update Your Resume Month to be joined by the spirit of St. Louis, Jahidi White. J-Dub attended Cardinal Ritter College Prep before attending Georgetown University, where he played for the legendary Hall of Fame coach, Big John, John Thompson. He played with the answer, Allen Iverson, while at Georgetown, as well as several other NBA players that I will talk about later, which I found very interesting when prepping for the show, including Ruben Boomche, who was also on our show and also says hello. He shares a birthday with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and Nikola Jokic of the Denver Nuggets. He was born the same year as Peyton Manning, Tim Duncan, Mr. Big Shot, Chauncey Billups, and the late Chadwick Boseman. He went on to play in the NBA from 1998 to 2005 for three different clubs after being drafted 43rd overall in the 98 draft by the Washington Wizards and scored almost the same number of points as rebounds. I've never seen a statistic like this. He scored 1,954 points and had 1,944 rebounds, literally almost identical numbers. Fascinating. He enjoys golfing and giving back to the basketball community as he is a high school coach at Mary Institute and St. Louis Country Day School, as well as for Nike Elite Youth Basketball in St. Louis. He's a partner in a medical ownership group. He was in a movie, Alien vs. Alien, on the Sci-Fi Channel. He loves the quote, "If you look at the people in your circle and you don't get inspired, then you don't have a circle, you have a cage." And Nelly mentioned him at the end of his hit song, St. Louis. You can find him on Instagram at Big Dog, H-A-D-O. And I'm sure you'll clarify how to actually pronounce it. So I didn't want to be presumptuous and guess, but
Hado.
And so truly honored whenever we still really don't know why people come into the Sports Deli Podcast, where everyone deserves a seat at the table to join us. But we're truly humbled and honored anytime anyone comes into the Sports Deli. So welcome. Way to get that karma.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Bernie Bickerstaff says hi.
Oh, yeah. Tell him what's up. That's my guy.
Yeah, I will. I'm trying to get him to come on, but, you know, he he likes to stay in the background.
Yeah, right.
You know, a lot of people don't know that basketball coaching tree. I'm sure you do, but the University of San Diego, between Hank Egan and Pop and Musselman and Mike Brown and Bernie, and I mean the list goes, it's University of freaking San Diego. It's unbelievable.
It is crazy. You know, I didn't know Mike and Bernie were both from University of San Diego.
Yep.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I just think about that now, it makes sense.
It's, yeah,
you know, it's actually all coming together for me. You know.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And if I hadn't, you know, been in San Diego since, you know, for the better part of 30 some years, I wouldn't have known that either. And, you know, being in the basketball community as a coach. But yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating. And it's funny, my Hall of Fame coach at the community college, James Moldahl, he used to play racquetball with Hank Egan. And so he used to come over to Mesa all the time and play. And, you know, I would say hello because I was a player back then. I wasn't having normal conversations with the guy. But, you know, and now looking back on it, it's just, you know, and then they obviously knew Tark. You know, it's just that whole crew back in the day, you know, they you know, it was a different kind of thing back then with coaches. Very interesting.
As big as the basketball industry is, it's a small world. Everybody's one step separated from everybody else, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Because Bernie was my first coach in the NBA, and Mike Brown was his assistant. Then I tried out again with Cleveland with Mike Brown. So it's first coaches always kind of want to offer you an opportunity to come back with them.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know the second part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, there's a lot of directions that you've gone lately. Maybe unexpectedly, you know, things come back into the forefront. Maybe we'll talk about that in a little while. But I always like to start out with people's childhoods, because when Jay Billis came on, you know, and I've said this just about in every podcast, because I found it fascinating that he had a terrible high school experience, you know, versus other people who had, you know, great experiences. So how was it spending time there, growing up there, and obviously your high school experience that led you where you are now?
Well, I mean, you know, growing up where you grow up, you don't know anything other than where where you are. So the city I grew up in, you know, it was the area I grew up in, had a lot of friends, you know, a lot of boys in my neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did everything all the boys did, play football in the street, rode our bikes, you know, and then just seemed like time started changing and everybody started speaking a different language. And I'm like, man, I don't know what language they're speaking anymore. You know, I know English, you know, but it ended up being drug talk. You know, everything turned to drug talk, you know, serving something here, Graham here. There's like, why? I feel like I was in chemistry class or something, you know? And so that's became all of my friends, you know. Then, you know, we used to ride bikes. Now I was riding bikes with guns in your pants. And they were just young kids still. At this time, we're just young kids. So, all the fun things we used to do as kids started changing, you know, the neighborhood started changing, you know, hanging out, just throwing footballs or, you know, throwing a baseball started changing to just hanging on the block and looking out for the police or shooting like dice on the, you know. So basketball just kind of opened up the world for me to have somebody, a lot of people around me that was on still the same frame of mind and the same common goal that I was on, you know. And so I think basketball started as something to where it was kids that were still just kids, you know, that still just had a love for a game of ball and get away. It was kind of a release, you know, an escape.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question real quick, because I'm from Detroit and, you know, I was integrated in fifth grade, and my high school was largely of the black and brown community. And there were guys that had Sterlings. There were guys coming to school, you know, obviously, and Max Julians and, you know, all the, you know, so, you know, it was an education for me, to say the least. And so obviously there was a lot of drugs, you know, where I went to school as well. But, you know, it was just something that was normal to me. Like, I was just like, what's up, yo? You know, like, it wasn't anything that was uncomfortable for me, because I just saw these guys every day for years. But the question I want to know is, why do you think there was that shift? Was it just simply money? What was it? Was it the family dynamic? You know, what was it exactly? Because this is an interesting thing to me that it's not really my space to necessarily talk about. But I do want to ask the question, because when Rashawn McLeod came on, he pivoted in the middle of the show and said, I really want to start talking about this, because it's just something within the black and brown community that are still issues, and we need to deal with not only the stuff that's on the outside, the noise and the people, you know, like white allies that have to come correct in white America, but we have to do some things ourselves. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on those types of things.
Well, I know from the city I'm from, St. Louis, it was more starting off just about opportunity. Then the first thing people see in our neighborhoods, the first thing we see as productive or somebody who has made it is the drug dealer. That's the first guy we see that actually represents money, not our parents.
Not the athlete?
Not if you don't have any athletes from your community.
Sports is sponsored by PSK. You can find them online at lids.com, pskcollective.com, tjmaxx.com, walmart.com, and now Kohl's Department Store at kohls.com. And now back to this incredible interview right here in the Sports Deli.
So first thing you can see that you can touch, that you can talk to, that you can, a person that you can know personally, that you can see with your own eyes, the guy with the brand new car, with the, you know, rims, the chain, with a, lots of money in his hand, is the drug dealer. That's the first person we see, right? So that's our first influence as a young kid, is that, like, all right, I want to be him. You know, that's the first role model you get, you know, unless it's, especially, you know, if it's not enough fathers in the area, you know, like I was privileged to have my mother and father both there growing up in the house. And but in my neighborhood, my father had to be a lot of people's father because it wasn't, you know, everybody didn't have a father.
So you think that's a big reason why you didn't go down that road?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I had no interest. I was just one of those kids that had no interest in something that I didn't have interest in. It didn't appeal to me. That's just simple as that. It didn't appeal to me. Like all my friends, I mean, I got a lot of friends, you know, growing up, it was all boys in my neighborhood. So it was a whole lot of us. And we hung every day, you know. And it just, when it started kicking in and, you know, drugs started kind of, you know, going into the neighborhoods and taking over, it became a different language to me. And it was like a foreign language. I didn't want to learn it.
Fascinating. Sports Deli is sponsored by SportRx, the leader in sport prescription eyewear. You can find them online at sportrx.com. And don't forget to enter the code DELI10 at checkout for your special 10% discount. And now back to this incredible interview right here on the Sports Deli. So you had, were you good in basketball and football, like right from the jump? Basketball was your first love?
I never played football, but
just in the street.
I don't think I wasn't good at basketball right from the jump, but I was tall. So, everybody around you always say, man, you tall, you should play ball. You should start playing ball. So, you know, every time we went to go play ball or, you know, go to the, you know, schoolyards, the first person they'd get is me. Then I have a lot of uncles, right? So I have a lot of uncles on my mother's side and my father's side. But my mother's side, they really was all about basketball. So they all lived in my neighborhood too, or lived close. So they had a van. So they pick all everybody up in the van and we'd hit every schoolyard, blacktop in the city. So I learned early in life, like young, to play against grown men. That really helped out too. So like now everybody does development and skill training. We didn't have that back then.
Right.
It was young men playing against grown men. And then you had to just learn your lessons bit by bit.
We talk about that street ball issue all the time on the show because, I mean, you don't win. You're waiting an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You better win.
Yeah. Got to win.
That's interesting. Your
goal. Yeah. You want to be out there for a while.
Can you talk about the influence of sneakers and music on your life growing up?
I think sneakers. I start with music first.
Yeah.
The influence of music with me personally was a way for me to travel and experience the world without ever leaving my block. You know, one thing about my block, and I always said this, man, like, it was the people on my block, they thought that was the entire world. Like, that was the entire world. The world exists right on those corners, right? And if they really went somewhere, they thought, like, oh, I went to Chicago or Detroit. Like, they thought they really been somewhere. And music made me be able to expand my like mental horizons beyond those corners, you know. So and so like music, especially East Coast music.
Yeah, I felt
like I can listen to Nas and felt like I was actually walking through Queensbridge, or you know,
right.
I can listen to it was a group, I think you remember them, like Soul to Soul, Back to Life. Yep. Now they were from London, you know,
right.
They from, and so I'm like, okay, so now place London exists. Let me explore this. And is this the London sound? So it takes you to, and now you know, doing research on, you know, London and Manchester and all those type of places overseas. And so music was a way for me to actually just travel the world in my, you know, sitting between two speakers in between my ears.
Yeah, and the same thing for me, obviously. You know, a lot of hip hop, obviously, in Detroit. But, you know, I remember listening to KRS-One and his lyrics. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, that was mind-blowing. You know, and then Public Enemy taking a stand, you know, with Fight the Power. And, right. you know, the other rappers, you know, Kool Moe Dee and LL getting into it. Or, mm-hmm. you know, Fat Boys were funny. You know, right. I mean, it was just, right. you know. Yeah, that's so interesting. And it was such a big part of everything we did, especially on the weekends. I mean, it was just a part of it. So right. Yeah, I can totally relate to that.
Sonically too, just the sound, yeah. something that's different, like Wu-Tang come out and you like sonically, they're so different.
Yeah.
That you can imagine what Staten Island looks like just off the, seeing and hearing the sounds of the music.
Yeah, and you talked about, you know, you get to travel the world through music, and, you know, there's a lot of influencers. I mean, honestly, rappers and hip-hop influence fashion, sneakers, you know, and obviously music in so many ways. And so to that point...
Culture in general.
Yeah, culture in general. And so, you know, Run DMC with Adidas, right? Oh, yeah. We talk about sneakers. So, you know, and sneakers isn't necessarily as big with some people.
Yeah, no one wanted Adidas before then.
Right, exactly.
I mean, they were a basketball shoe, but no one wanted Adidas before then. Like, we didn't want those three leaves on our shoe.
Exactly.
That wasn't nothing major, you know. After after Run DMC promoted those shell toes like that.
Yeah.
Man, you couldn't. I still want a pair to this day.
Or top tens or whatever. Yeah.
Stan Smiths.
Man, that's crazy. That's hilarious. Oh, I love it. And even Jack Purcells are back in style now.
Oh, yeah.
30
yeah.
years later. That's crazy. Oh, yeah. Oh, man. So interesting. Okay. So so you're getting ready to graduate. And so who was interested in you besides Big John, or was it a no-brainer? Because, you know, it's a PWI, right? It's a predominantly white institution. So even though Big John's there. Was that something that you were worried about, or was it just him?
I didn't know it was a predominantly white institution. Okay. But yeah, I'm sure you heard this many times.
Yeah.
You know, growing up, everybody had Georgetown, like everything on anything, a Georgetown sweater, Georgetown hat, Georgetown. Yeah. You know, you look and so that's the first, before you even see the team, it becomes a staple in the community of just apparel wise of. This is a hot clothes. This is the shit, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first time you ever experienced Georgetown before you even know much about the team. Then you start watching the team. You see a black coach. You see the entire team black. You could, if you didn't know better, you could mistakenly think it was an HBCU.
Right, for sure.
Right. So that's the first thing about Georgetown. Like, I didn't even know until I got on campus. I was like, whoa, what? Where am I? You know, then you had to learn, oh, it's a prestigious university. You know, it's pretty much right under Ivy League, but you don't know that before. But getting back to your question is with recruiting.
Yeah.
Georgetown was late to the table. You know, I had Kansas, Kentucky, Villanova, UNLV, Michigan, Temple, right? I had all those schools already. You know, and something about it was like, I just always loved Georgetown. And I always loved the big man U, you know. I like the nostalgia of how, you know, being young, I had some Georgetown gear and it got ripped. And I wore that ripped gear the entire year because I didn't want that bulldog to, you know, I want to still, I still wanted to wear it.
Yeah.
So it all came back to full circle to the point that when they so I end up going to the I think it was a Nike some type of Nike invitation thing when Kevin Garnett there first time I met Allen Iverson, a lot of guys there, right? And some bald head dude come up to me, right? And he was working the camp. He just befriended me. Like, hey man, what's up? And I was like, all right, well, cool. You work here. You work the camp. I see you every day anyway. I don't mind talking to you. And by the end of that damn camp, all we talked about was Georgetown. Him and I, we just kept talking about Georgetown, right?
That's fascinating.
Right. So I don't know if he kind of put the bug in or how it went. So long story short, I guess I could tell the story now. I get on campus the first day after I signed with Georgetown.
Stelly is sponsored by Moolah Kicks. Moolah is M-O-O-L-A-H, like money, Moolah. And Kicks, like shoes, one word. You can find them online at moolahkicks.com. And it's the first ever female-only brand basketball shoe. So it's a shout-out to the basketball street culture. And it is also about fighting social injustice and gender inequality worldwide and here in the United States. And again, you can find them at moolahkicks.com. And now back to this incredible interview right here in the Sports Deli.
He's Coach's nephew. He's the head of security of Georgetown University. He's Coach's nephew. So I'm like, oh, okay. So everybody else came to my house and talked to me.
But he never said it at the time. He was just talking.
Never said it.
What was your relationship with John Chaney?
I like John Chaney. I like John Chaney a lot.
I really like him. Those 5 a.m. practices.
I on the recruiting visit, they told me I had to get up at 5 o'clock. I'm like, p.m.? No, a.m. We have practice. We want you to see practice. I was like, okay. So, and I used to ask the players, okay, how do you get up at 5 a.m.? You can't do anything. And I was like, well, we still try to get out, but we got to make sure we're up at 5 a.m. Like, nah, I'm not for that.
Yeah, it wasn't definitely for everybody. So talk about the late Big John, obviously. His impact may even be felt more down the road as we navigate these spaces of social injustice. You know, talk about your relationship with him and not only what he meant while you were there, but after you left.
So Big John was tough, just a tough all around. You know, he was like the godfather. You know, one thing about, you know, I could leave campus and go to the mall, then I can go see a girl who lived in D.C. somewhere, and I would get back on campus. He was like, so you went to the mall, you went to see that girl over in Northeast? He would know exactly everywhere I went, and I'm like, how did he know that? Like, son, I know everything with everything. I have eyes everywhere. And that's when I first got, you know, when I first got there. So I'm like, okay, this dude's different. This is something completely different than I'm used to.
But he wasn't doing it necessarily just for what may seem obvious to a lot of people. He was doing it because he had to protect not only the brand of Georgetown, but he wanted to make sure that he was educating and you understand the landscape, or was it just that he had to in that space know what everyone was doing because it was the fragility of it was too serious?
First, he was that big. Secondly, people understood how he protected his players, and to the point to where they loved the school and loved him so much that they were going to be a part of that mission that he was part of. So then a lot of people in the city was like, hey, your players down here right now. Hey, you know. So, and they would call, just let them know. So he had a lot of guys like that because they love and respected Big John so much, just because how much he stood for the black community and how much he stood up for black kids and how much he was willing to risk everything. You know, one thing about
But before he walked off the court, I mean, how did people know that? Just because he's recruiting kids of color, like, I mean, how did that message get out? It wasn't like he was overtly talking about these things, like, and social media wasn't a thing, and you know, it wasn't something that got traction back then necessarily. Was it just word of mouth and just whispering throughout the community on the streets that, hey, if you want your son to be looked after, go to Georgetown, and then that was it?
So I think it's first because they know, you know, he's from Archbishop Carroll. He's been around a long time. They knew what he stood for first.
I got you.
Secondly, Georgetown was an all-white institution,
right,
that never, ever had black kids that he play up there. Right? Now, not only that, he just brings all black team, all black coach with not being apologetic about it at all, right? And then he makes the institution have a D1 program. They never had a D1 program,
right?
You know, so and he created one of the creators of the Big East,
right?
So then when you start watching him interviews, you start seeing how unapologetic he was about who he was, you know, and how strong he stood on things about who he was and what he meant for it. And he didn't care about ruffling feathers for fighting for, you know, what young black boys need. He didn't bite his tongue, you know, and believe it or not, he got a lot of flack for that. One thing about most people don't know, he walked around with bodyguards. He had, in practice, he had to have every door guarded.
Wow.
Bodyguard, because he had so many death threats.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, he had a lot of death threats.
What did he say in practice consistently as far as social injustice? Because, you know, we're trying to get Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf on the show to talk about his experience. And back then, it wasn't the same type of thing. People have been protesting for years in the black and brown community. There just hasn't been white allies like there is now as much. And for some reason, the death of George Floyd triggered a lot of this stuff, and Colin Kaepernick as well. But did people take to what he was saying? You know, what did he say in practice? Was it, hey, you know, we all got to take a stand. There's got to be a united front. There's got to be strength in numbers. Like, it's going to take time, but, you know, we're going to change the narrative that's, you know, been incorrect in this country for far too long, but we just got to stick together. Like, was it that, you know, direct, or was it, you know, just, hey, look out for each other, and that it was just understood?
It was even more direct.
Wow.
And it was even more direct. And he basically said, hey, he knew he was raising young black boys to black men. And he was like, you all gonna be black men in America. So everything he, like, one thing about Coach that people don't know is practice would be way too long. I think we're only supposed to practice like 2 hours. We would practice 4 hours. At least 3.5, right? But in those 3.5 to 4 hours, it was always about 45 to an hour break of just him putting everybody in the stand, sitting to everybody in the bleachers or in chairs. And he would go over like current events. You had to know current events. You would have to, sometimes he'll pass a tie around. And if you didn't know how to, it made everybody learn how to tie a tie. Like, if you don't know how to tie a tie, you're not a man. You got to learn how to tie a tie. He would talk about, you know, he always used to say things like, the man who knows why would always have a job. The man who knows how would always be his boss, you know? And he would just, it's so many things that he would just pour into us. You know, one time it was a Million Man March going on, and he said, everybody raise your hand to, if you think we should, not have practice, and everybody should go to Million Man March, take off and go to Million Man March. And everybody was like, no, we're not raising our hand. How dare we not say, hey, the coach, we're not having practice. And we got in trouble for we actually got in trouble for not saying we should go to Million Man March to take off practice, right? Because he was like, this is a historical thing for Black people, and you all are too scared to say, you know, stand up about that. We not practicing. And the fact that you thought that we should, like, we got in trouble for that. Mm-hmm. Like, but that's how strong he was on that. You know, he was in his office, he always had a ball right on his desk, and it was deflated basketball.
Sports Deli is sponsored by City Lokes, CityLocs. You can find them online at citylokes.com, where you can go and make your own personalized license plate hats. They're so cool. You got to check them out. And don't forget to enter the code THESPORTSDELI at checkout for your special 10% discount. And now back to this incredible interview right here in the Sports Deli.
And you're like, well, why? If we're a basketball, you're a basketball coach, why is the ball deflated on your desk? You're like, because the ball stops dribbling after a while. The ball will stop dribbling. What happens after the ball deflates? I'm preparing for you, you know, for the rest of your life. You know, when the ball deflates, everything I'm doing for you right now is the career before basketball and after basketball. You know, and what thing about him? He was tough, man. He was like having a drill sergeant for 4 years straight. Like he would pick his weeks, and you would just be the guy for the week. You know, and he would drive you, you know. But one thing about him is when after Georgetown, when I got hurt my senior year. So,
right.
You know, my stock just plummeted. Mm-hmm. And he was like, are you ready? Ready for it? He said, we got to get back out here. Season over with. I had season over with. And he was like, we got to get you in the NBA. Right. So. Like, don't matter if you're healed or not, we got to go. So every day he worked with me and all the coaches, he just been working all the time in the gym. And he's like, don't worry about an agent right now. I'll be your agent. Everywhere you go, just know I'll be in the stands. This like NBA, those kind of camps to where like
right.
the guys who are on a tier or may not make it all working out. I'm looking at him in the stands every day. He's doing work.
Fascinating.
Know. And after every day in the camp, we have dinner. And he was like, you done now? I was like, coach treated me differently. He's like, you're a man now. You know, I don't have to curse you. I'll tell you to run. We on the same playing field now. We both men. You know, and that's how he was. You know, and coach just amazing, man. Because, you know, most guys after they leave college, you know, you're like, okay, it's a revolving door. You going out, somebody else coming in. Nice to see you. I don't have nothing else to do with you. He just wasn't like that with his guys.
You know, I've asked Jelani McCoy and some other guys, Rashawn and, you know, others that have played at Carolina about the brotherhood. And so what's it been like now, you know, some 20 plus years later to have those relationships with all those guys that went to Georgetown? And I would imagine it's a little bit different because when you have a legend like him or Coach K, you know, or even a John Shaney, you know, Lute Olson, there's just certain coaches that are just different, that it's not just the experience that you went to that institution for 4 years, but you played for someone who spoke to you in here and struck a chord in a way that some coaches just will never be able to do. Can you speak on that brotherhood?
Yeah, that brotherhood is unique. It's a bond that now can't be unbroken because we know that we went through hell and you know, good and bad, you know, you went through hell, but it was all worth it for a common goal. And we gained so much insight and knowledge from a guy that was, you know, this amazing man. And I don't care what coach you name out here in this world, how prestigious, how what they accomplished.
Yeah.
You will not be able to replace a guy like John Thompson.
Anymore. Well, it's not just basketball. It was just he stood for the right thing in every way.
Everything. Yeah. Everything. Because he just wasn't your basketball coach. I mean, he was full-time. You know, he was driving around campus. You just didn't see him doing basketball time.
Right.
You know, you saw him doing maybe early in the morning. You saw him knocking on your door. in your dorm room. He'll call you. You know, he'll talk. It may be 3 o'clock at night. He'll call you, tell you, come down, sit in his car. And you like, what did I do? Okay. Like, he talking about just random things, you know, and that's how he was, you know, just all, and he was a leader, and he protected his guys, you know.
Yeah.
Like, he had his guys back, and he taught you to have each other's back, you know, and he taught you about this world in a way that most men wouldn't be able to talk to you about in a corporate environment. You know, he was real with us, you know, with everything. So, you know, just losing him, it was a big loss, you know, but he's one of those irreplaceable people.
Let me fast forward a little bit. Usually I go in order chronologically, but I find it interesting what you just talked about. And I mentioned it earlier about the death of George Floyd and how that has impacted the community. And a big reason why we pivoted on this show was because I don't want to be complicit anymore as a white Jewish man. And I want to make sure that I'm doing anything I can to keep the conversation going. You know, I'm not Greeny, you know, I'm not Jay Billis. I'm not Tom Brady. Who I've been very critical of on this show. But I am educating a lot of white people, I think, hopefully not ramming it down their throat, but at least teaching them that the more guests that come on, which is near 100 now, that talk about their stories and these subjects, it's never going to get old to me. I don't care if I do this for 10 more years and talk about the same things for the next 10 years. Because until the narrative changes, until things are more equal, until our future children see things in a way that the current generation doesn't, then the conversation and the policies need to continue and change respectively. So what I asked Jim Trotter this question, you know, from NFL.com a couple of days ago, and he's not as hopeful as maybe I am. Maybe I'm naive, but I'm just wondering now, a year and a half later, after the murder of George Floyd, and obviously he's not the only one, so we shouldn't oversimplify this. You know, it's Ahmaud Arbery, it's Breonna Taylor. There's many. But what where's your heart right now when it comes to social injustice?
With social injustice, I like that it's being magnified, right? I like that it's being magnified to the point to where it's on a big platform and it's being thrown in your face. What I realize is, as much as it's being magnified and thrown in your face, as much as we create, show, put facts out there and show things and, you know, saying things like Black Lives Matter, somehow it's always a counter that's created, right? If it's Blue Lives Matter is just a counter to Black Lives Matter, right? It's not because you actually cared about the police before, because you didn't. Blue Lives Matter didn't exist before, or all that. So,
I want to clarify that point, because anyone that's listening is probably saying, "Yeah, well, cops' lives matter," or, you know, "Everyone lives matter." So I heard this the other day, and it really brought it home for me. So we had another hurricane in New Orleans, right? And so someone that lives in New Orleans, would you say to them, "I'm so sorry about this hurricane situation. It, you know, it's the second time it's happened, if not more, right? You know, Katrina was the first time that we all really talked about it. But all the other 49 states matter."
But like,
you wouldn't say something so stupid like that. But for some reason, people are okay with saying all lives matter. No, all lives don't matter until Black Lives Matter. Just like you wouldn't be so insensitive and say, "Well, the other 49 states matter. Sorry about your hurricane, but yeah, but all the states should matter." It's so stupid. It's so stupid. But sometimes you have to frame it in a different way so that people can understand it.
But you don't have to frame it a different way. You don't. Because they know exactly what you're saying. Just like we keep explaining it. We keep explaining what's already understood. Right? And they keep coming. But the problem is, it's always some counter to it, because they can't bring themselves to admit that they have the understandings, because it won't fit anything.
But we're not going to talk to those people, right? We're going to talk to the people that may want to sit down at the table with us, because the other people aren't going to listen.
It's a lot of people that may, this is what I'm realizing, a lot of people that may want to sit down at the table, but until it said choose a side. Now, if you have to choose a side, you it's mandatory you choose a side, the same people that sat down at the table with you may not choose a side you expect them to, right? But there's going to be people that will sit down at the table with you and stand strong. So don't get me wrong about that either. But, you know, it's funny how you realize kind of who your friends are. And they're still your friends. They are your friends. They've been your friends. But when it comes down to changing the order of things, them losing a little bit of control or the privilege, no matter how much they say they won't exist, they can't fathom, you know, they can't fathom losing that privilege or fathom the world being any other way. Because so, and it's almost just like,
but that's that's a distorted point of view, right? Because it's counterintuitive. Actually, when you allow everyone from the Black and Brown community, the Asian community to have seats at the table, it actually enhances businesses and it improves things because you're getting different points of view, women. But for some reason, like you're saying, they're afraid of losing this control and the money, right? And so, it's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense logically.
Right. So think about it. I mean, think about the world now. Like the world wouldn't ever be this bold as they are now, just with blatant racism or, hey, we got to, you know, we got to hold strong. Like we got to, no matter what's in our face, no matter what we see, we're going to tell you something different because it's all about power and control. Like America literally sees things as they are and see people saying, hey, I'm going to have to tell you something different than it is. And just so we can just keep things the way they are with tradition and power control. Because, I mean,
right.
Usually they try to hide it behind something or say it with something else, you know, to cover it up. But while they also try to retake the... And it's not that... It's never just been so in your face, you know? But that's because it's dire straits now. Like, it's...
How are you treated in the business world? Because you're a part of a big ownership group. How has it been for you? Do you face any of that type of stereotypical, you know, or blatant racism?
Well, the crazy thing about the ownership group I'm with is a Black person, an Indian person, and an Italian person. So you cover a lot of spectrum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so believe it or not, no, I haven't, you know, because...
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, no, I haven't, because we have experience in our fields and we experts in our fields, and
right.
You know, and we all look out for each other.
Well, that's progress, I would imagine. I mean, there has been progress, but we're still living in a time where there are a lot of issues and policy changes need to change. How do you feel when Kyle Korver and JJ Redick speak to this issue the way that they have and been so outspoken as white allies, talking about unapologetic allies?
I feel like I'm glad they're doing it, because that's the thing. We need that. We definitely, you know, we can talk to you blue in the face, but until it's other white guys that's, you know, it's allies that's talking, that's saying, you know, speaking up like Coach Pop and, you know, Steve Kerr, that's when you start, you're getting people who literally close their ears, actually say, hey, let me try to listen just because of this guy.
Right.
But the problem is, to me, is just because they're all in the part of the NBA, the NBA organization, everybody has an NBA brand on them. They say, oh, they're just doing what the rest of the NBA does. You know, the NBA, you know, LeBron James got Black Lives Matter, everybody has. So they're just following the NBA trend, you know. And I feel like that gets washed over because of that, you know, because it's, instead of saying, no, it's a true feelings, you know. You know, so like the NFL guys, you know, they've been, to me, they kind of been kind of had their hands cuffed a lot and wasn't able to say a lot, you know. And so if you see somebody like Roger Goodell or, you know, the owner of the Cowboys, if they really ever spoke up on our behalf, if they felt that way and spoke up on our behalf, that would really open a lot of ears and eyes up.
I heard Mark Cuban talk on Clubhouse about how he's met with a lot of football owners and they don't listen to him. And he's one of the wealthiest guys in the world. And he's another one, along with Steve Kerr and Popovich, who was an advocate and a phenomenal owner. You know better than I do. You're talking about a very deep, good old white boy network. It's a very complicated
narrative. It don't, anything that probably deals with social injustice, they probably see it as somehow taking power away from them and money is power and taking money away from them.
Yeah.
And even though their organization, that the NFL, it wouldn't be anything without the black guys. That's actually putting on the show every day.
Can you name one white guy from the NFL who has any sort of pull or leverage that has said Black Lives Matter that you can think of? Right, you can't. And so this is why I've been critical of Tom Brady. And so Jim Trotter took it a step further, and he's like, Tom has every right to do what he wants to do, and he's part of a coalition now, so at least he's put his name on something. But he also had a MAGA hat in his locker room.
He did.
During all this BS. And so Jim's point was, which I didn't think of, was if you're not going to overtly say Black Lives Matter, which I cannot for the life of me understand why that's so difficult for people to say, whether or not you believe in the origin of the group, it wasn't the point. The point was to be an ally. That's the point. And so for him to, everyone makes mistakes. Maybe he didn't see it that way and he just wants to support his buddy. But for someone like that, who could even now have so much impact, if he just came out and said Black Lives Matter, he's throwing the Lombardi trophy around, and he's making millions of videos with Gronk. And God, it's so fucking insulting on so many levels to me that you have that platform and you will not publicly come out once a month, a couple times a year, do your own commercial, do it in a tweet, something that says Black Lives Matter. And
would it be genuine if he did?
Well, maybe now it would, because he's learned more. And maybe if he did it initially, it would have been a stunt. But I would argue now, even though he's pissed me off to no end, you know, and like I said, I'm not trying to judge him because he has a right to do what he wants. I'm just saying, with his platform, I cannot give him a pass. He gets a pass with so many things, whether it's the cheating, whether he was part of it or not, you know, or anything else. Like, I just can't in this climate give Tom Brady a pass when it comes to this type of thing. And like I said, he's part of this coalition that Jim Trotter talked about, but it's not enough. It's just not enough. And there are strength in numbers. We've seen there are strength in numbers because of Colin and everyone else that came before him, John Carlos and everyone, Kareem, Jim Brown, everyone that's come before, so that now if someone speaks out, women, people in the black and brown community, they're not ostracized. Their endorsements aren't hurt. The contracts aren't going to be hurt in the same way, because now you're encouraged to speak out in a way that you've, you know, what weren't encouraged to do before.
True. But would he lose a lot from, I think.
What can he lose? What's he going to lose?
I'm just saying, I think Tom likes to, first of all, I don't know. I think, you know, he's in a conservative world. He always have been. I think his entire surroundings have just been.
But he's been in locker rooms. He's right there.
Right, but he's not.
Man.
He's not.
So your point about Jerry Jones, it's the same thing. Like, if Jerry Jones is the same thing and spoke out, like, you know, the Cleveland Browns owner has, you know, been an ally, but nobody knows who that person is. Nobody cares.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you.
That's just frustrating. So one of the things I found fascinating, the people that you played with in the NBA are a fascinating collection of people. You played with Juwan Howard, head coach of the Michigan Wolverines. You played with Calvert Chaney, now coaching in the NBA with the Pacers. Played with Tim Legler, works on ESPN. Rod Strickland works in the G League. Jeff McGinnis coaches high school and club ball. Tracy Murray, part of UCLA's broadcasting team. Mitch Richmond, one of the sickest through the leg crossovers that you ever saw. Ben Wallace, just inducted into the Hall of Fame. You also play with Hubert Davis, current head coach of North Carolina Tar Heels. Rip Hamilton, Ty Lue, who's now coaching the NBA. You know, Etan Thomas, who was on our show, you know, and I know you've talked extensively with him about some of the things that have gone on with the media, which I want to touch on, because the media's narratives, especially with people of color, are another thing that's very frustrating to me, and the double standard. Juan Dixon, now coaching at Coppin State. Penny Hardaway, coaching at Memphis. Amari Stoudemire, Stephon Marbury, Steve Smith, Kwame Brown. I mean, the guys that you, Michael Jordan, like the guys that you played with. I mean, I look at the rosters all the time when I prep for the show, because I think it's very interesting. But can you talk about the impact of those people on you, not only when you were in the league, but now? Because that the one thing that stood out to me were the collection of leaders that all those guys turned out to be, including yourself. And I just find that, just amazing.
I say like this, the guys that were the most humble, more...
Best teammates,
the ones that really, that were just down to earth, you know your family, you know cared, their family.
Cared about you.
They cared about the other guys.
Yeah.
Had no ego. Well, most of those guys you named and why they're where they are. Mm-hmm. Now, it was guys who had crazy egos that, you know, wanted their own parking spots and crazy things like that, that you didn't name, you know. And it was crazy because you learned a lot. And sometimes you think the grass is greener. When I played with Washington, I never been with a tighter knit of teammates. I mean, I don't understand why we didn't win as many games as we should have, because I would Juwan Howard, Rod Strickland, Mitch Richmond, Calvert Chaney, Tracy Murray, Richard Hamilton, Michael Jordan, Etan Thomas. That group, those guys, you could say, hey, be at my house tomorrow at 5:00. I have something. I need you to be there. And the entire team would show up right away, right? Mm-hmm. No one was better, no matter who had the lowest contract or the highest contract, no one was ever better than anyone else. We did everything as a team and friendship and family. And, you know, it wasn't like, hey, I'm the best, so I sit in the back of the bus. It just was none of that. And until I went to other teams, I realized that really wasn't how the NBA was. Hmm. And so the guys you're naming are those type of guys. Those guys had, to me, those guys always stood on something. They already had, you know, stood for something. They had some type of foundation, no matter what type of world they were from, no matter, you know, how their upbringing was, they had some foundation before they became NBA player. You know what I'm saying? So they're who they were. They were already established who they were before they entered the NBA.
Now, I want to ask you a question. I don't want to oversimplify this, because there's always a lot of issues why teams win or don't win. But you're a coach now. And so you understand how to bring out the best version of someone. And I've heard you talk about this with Etan on his show. And it's not meant to bash anybody. But what does it take for coaches at that level? And do you see a difference now versus back then to bring out the best in somebody? Because you don't need a John Thompson choosing you to be their whipping boy for that week to make you a man in the NBA. Right. Because you're all on the same playing field now. So, and I know you've talked about Doug Collins, and there's people been on the show that talked about Paul Westphal in the same way, you know, that they just didn't get it. Just like Jay Billis talked about his high school coach. So it's at every level, right? That there's people that just don't understand it, don't seek a greater understanding. And consequently, they cannot possibly bring out the best version of themselves or their players. And so it does start at the top, right? I mean, yeah, okay, the players decide who wins or loses, but you need strong leadership. And at every level in every sport, you see great leaders winning. It's not by luck that the culture is created the way that it is. So talk about how you get the best version of your kids every day, and what was missing back then to your question as to why you didn't win more.
Well, I think with it being a coach, first thing is, you know, when you get in there, first of all, a player has to know that you know what you're doing. You know, you have to know more or be open to the advice of your veteran point guard. That's off top, right? Because if you don't bring a system in where your veteran point guard can be successful, then everything falls downhill from there. That's first of all. Secondly, you have to be respected, which means a lot of coaches always seek advice from other players, but it's about another player. You could never do that, right? Right. So, like, I can't call you into the, you know, my room, my hotel room, say, hey, I want to sit down with you and let's talk about basketball, and then say, hey, what do you think about Etern? What do you think about Calvin?
Versus, hey, do you think he's okay? Like, is everything okay? Like, that's different. Like,
versus, hey, you know, is he, right. Yeah, I'm concerned about him. Is anything right. I can help with, you know?
Right.
You know, and a lot of coaches do that, you know? A lot of coaches.
Still today?
Yeah, that happens.
Wow.
Yeah, that still happens. Also, you have to set all your players up for success, you know, down the line. Okay, let me really understand my players, know their strengths and their weaknesses, and put them in a system, create a system with their strengths and their weaknesses, or make sure they fit the system, you know. And you got to be able to be willing to take, be able to be a player's coach, be able to say, hey, what do you all think about this? Let's throw some things back and forth. How about, does this work for you? Well, you know, take some input. A lot of coaches have big egos. They can't take input. And then you have to be able to have a system of development.
Yeah.
You know, not just winning, but development. A lot of coaches just all about X and O's of winning, and they can produce a
short-term success, but not long-term.
Yeah, they can produce a position. They can produce right. you for a position, but can they produce you as a player?
Right. That's fascinating. Well, your kids are lucky to have you being a part of their lives, paying it forward. I mean, I would love to play for you. Man, that would be, I'd be fired up just at the mere thought of it. I would be itching for game day. That's how you want it, right? You want kids to be excited about it. You don't want to play in fear.
Right, yeah, yeah. You want kids to have a passion for it. What you really want as a coach is kids that will do anything for their damn teammates.
Yeah.
Like, you want kids that will run through walls for their teammates more than you running through for you, right? You don't want ever want to have a kid to quit on his teammates. You know?
And teach them how to be a good teammate.
That's kind of how you measure success.
You teach them how to be a good teammate, how to pick someone up if they fall down, you know, what to say to them. Like, do you have to teach them those things? Because, you know, guys will complain and be like, you know, hey, man, I can't, what kind of pass was that? Or, you know, like, do you have to teach them, like, every example of what it's like?
Yeah, well, you know, different basketball is different now. You know, everybody takes things different.
Yeah.
You know, so.
You got an old school mentality with a new age millennium.
That's
kind
exactly
of
what it is. Yeah. And so you can't relinquish everything. You can't give up a lot, you know, because, you know, these kids these days, if you give up too much, they just keep trying. Yeah, so you've got to keep that old school, because it worked before, you know. So,
well, if they know you care about them, that's they're going to go through the wall for you, you know, even if you have a different approach, or it's scary at first, or they don't understand it at first. They understand your true intentions in the long run.
They know they have to know that you're 100% can get on it, get in their ass, but you 100% will have their back no matter what case, you know.
Exactly.
Like, no one mess with any of my players. These are my sons. He's like my sons, right? That's first of all, you know. Second of all, they gotta know you kind of gotta be crazy than they are. You know, they gotta be understanding up top. Hey, we may have a different level of understanding of what crazy is. So let's get that understood.
Well, right? They want to know that you have the passion still too.
Right, right. Yeah. And they want to know you had a passion. And then in the end of the day, they want to know that your main goal is for them to be somewhere after they leave high school.
Right.
Right. Like, you're not just like Coach Thompson just did prepare us for the NBA, or just prepare us for wherever we go. He prepared us when the ball deflated, right?
Yeah.
They want you to know that you have that same passion throughout their entire timeline of life, of that you preparing them throughout, even when the ball deflates.
That's awesome. I want to ask a couple more questions. I know what your time is like, but the media, and the reason I want to ask this question is because from my perspective, I've heard a couple people talk about the narratives within the white community about how they see black athletes. And so when Stephen A. Smith, for show, or if that's whether or not he feels that way, you know, starts talking about things, it doesn't matter who it is. And obviously you play with Kwame, and I know you've talked about it extensively, but I just want to ask you a question from this standpoint. Does Stephen A. have a responsibility to not just be an entertainer, but to advocate in a way that he's not right now for the black and brown community, and doing what he did, does that hurt things on many layers when he's doing that kind of thing to Kwame? Which, I mean, it was so frustrating, and to hear Kwame come back and stuff, and obviously I hope he leverages it, because you know he's got a lot to offer, but you know him as a person and what he had to deal with back then, and to have to deal with it again, you know, to relive it in some ways is just it's upsetting to me to have to watch him to have to go through that again.
Right. Well, so I guess your first question is, does he have a responsibility? Yes and no. I don't think you can lay the responsibility on Stephen A's back, because I don't think it would be a genuine responsibility that he could take on, right? I think Stephen A is an actor. He's a character, right?
But why does he defend Naomi Osaka for mental health, and he doesn't get to know Kwame in a way where he can create a different narrative, and he would still get as much support, and if not, have more?
No, so don't forget what I'm saying. Don't. Stephen A has, to me, he's have bought into the character. The character has got him far enough to where he's going to do whoever pays the character and whatever the, you know, they say, hey, this character needs to do this, right? I personally never really been fond of Stephen A. You know, I just felt like I just saw a character the entire time. I didn't really see, and I think that's where a lot of journalists get confused, right? One thing Coach told me, it was funny, and if you can look back and really see the history of who Stephen A. genuinely is, genuine, like who he really is.
Right.
He said, one person you watch out for is Stephen A. Smith. Coach Thompson told me that. He said, I want to kick his ass. That's exactly what he said. And I was wondering why. So if you see how Stephen A. did things, you know, he was at the Philadelphia Inquirer,
right,
and he wanted to move up. And he realized how I can move up is writing, getting close to the players, and then writing a devastating story about them that bashed the players. And he did this to one of my best friends and college teammates, right? I mean, there was no reason for him to write that story. There was no reason for him to do what he did, other than to get some, to garner the attention he needed to move up to the next level, right? And that's who he is. And that he's always been doing it. That's has been his MO the entire time. Let me bash somebody. I would be the person who bashed them for you. I would be the person, because you can't do it. You can't do it. No matter how much lack of expertise I have in this game, I would be the person that'd be the sacrificial guy that go out here and kill everybody for you, right? And that's been his thing. So I learned about him, Stephen A., much earlier when Coach talked to me about him. And so, you know, he was a guy I always never really liked or was fond of, and just stayed clear from. So when Kwame talks about him, I understand why Kwame feels that way, because Kwame sees right through him too. A lot of players see right through him. I don't believe if guys didn't need to be sportscasters or wanted to be in the broadcasting business after their career, no one really would be a friend, befriend Stephen A. He's not a guy you would ever think of befriending. He's not a guy that you would ever, he's not a guy you ever hang around.
Yeah, but there's a difference between, you know, being an entertainer and actually changing narratives so that you affect and impact contracts or putting food on the table, as Kwame has talked about, and others. You know, so you create these narratives and they do influence owners and general managers. They have in the past and they still do. So that's where I think it gets to a dangerous level. And not just to mention the narrative of talking about people in the Black and brown community, which is just frustrating, you know, in and of itself.
Well, that's his number one job. That's what he was created to be. That's why he's there. You know, that's what he set up. He set that niche area role, that niche area and that role up to be that person. That's how he became in it. That's how he came in the industry. That's how he became a big figure in the industry, being that exact guy. You know, when most people wouldn't, you know, like most people have integrity and wouldn't ever do that. He was like, I don't have no integrity. I do exactly that, what you want me to do, to down all these guys and to say I have all these fake sources that I have to and diminish these so that I can take food out of their mouth. Take food out of their family's mouth. And then, you know, and he always say the counter. I'm not trying to take any.
Right. Too late.
But that's how it's the same thing as Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. Right. It's
exactly.
No, you know, so it's that's his thing, you know, and everybody sees what he's doing, you know, and now he's saying, but he's just now he's a monster. Now he's became just a monster, you know, and people are now calling him out on it, you know. But he's now a monster for the machine.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the rapid fire. Are there better conversations in a barber shop or in a locker room?
Well, that's tough. It's completely different conversation. it's different topics. I'm choosing the locker room.
There you go. With no media members present.
Right, exactly.
Old-fashioned razor or electric razor?
I'm going electric.
Sanford and Son or All in the Family?
Sanford and Son.
Oh, man. Wow, that's interesting. So, best mama joke. Your mom is so fat, she jumped in the air and got stuck. Your mom is so skinny, she hula hoops with a Cheerio. Your mom is so dumb, she thought a quarterback was a rebate. Or your mom is so fat, I told her to haul ass, and it took her 2 trips.
I got some much better ones than that. So,
oh, go ahead, give me two choices. Give me two choices.
I'm gonna go. They not for prime time. I'm gonna go with the jumping in the air and got stuck, just because that's what I used to use as a kid.
That's funny. Good times or what's happening?
Good times.
Loving basketball or white man can't jump?
White man can't jump.
Man, MJ or Kobe?
MJ.
Kobe or Larry Bird?
Larry Bird.
Wow. How did Kobe's death impact you?
It actually hurt a lot. It hurt a lot. I mean, if you're an NBA player, you respect Kobe. I think Kobe's worth ethic was even higher than Michael Jordan's. His worth ethic.
Yeah.
Right. His determination, his mentality, his obsessiveness.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're an NBA player, you like, okay, that's abnormal. No one can go to that level of wanting to be the great. Everybody wants to be great. Everybody works their butt off at being great. Some people work even harder than others at being great. But no one has even attempted to go to the level of obsession as Kobe has. And that's what really reflected in his game, you know.
Totally.
Right. And just the mentality and like the dog, you know, no matter who it was, I don't care if it was, you know, a giant, you know, he's gonna try to climb him out, you know, and try to put the giant in the headlock. That's the respect. No matter what, you have to respect someone that way, you know. So yeah, it hurt a lot. I couldn't believe it. And then he just, and like I'm sure you felt this way too. Like not Kobe, He's invincible. He's the only person you think that if that did happen, he would survive it.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Ugh, and his family. Ugh.
Oh, man. And his family, just daughter. Yeah, that's sad.
Ugh. Who's your favorite player to watch in the NBA right now?
I like watching Joel Embiid. I like watching Giannis a lot. I like watching KD.
You think Westbrook can be a guard version of Giannis playing bully ball for the Lakers? I think it's a good fit. How do you feel?
I'm always skeptical of Westbrook because
I was too, but I thought about it. You know, when I watched Giannis last year sort of play bully ball and hit a couple mid ranges to, you know, mix it up, I feel like Westbrook could do the same thing as a guard because he doesn't need to do all that shooting. He can just play bully ball, back people down, smaller guards, and then let everyone else do the other stuff. He's not going to hit the game-winning shot.
No, I'm not. So can Westbrook get his during the regular season? Yes. But when it gets time to be on a team where you have to be a little bit higher.
Like Paul George.
Make decisions more of a higher IQ wise.
Yeah.
Right. So to be able to be more sound, to be able to think three steps ahead. I don't know. I've never seen that in Westbrook.
You think LeBron can help him with that?
Maybe, but you know, Westbrook is a veteran too. So if first of all, if he's willing to listen, and then if he can really envision it, you know, he can really see that far into the game. You know, some people, one thing about basketball, you're only good as your IQ in the game. You know, some people are very smart. Is Westbrook a smart player? Yes. But LeBron is a genius, right?
LeBron will tell the other team about their own plays when they forget them.
Right. So with Westbrook's position, you know, he's not like a Kyrie who just so talented they can do. And Kyrie, to me, is another genius, too. Some geniuses are just, you know, extreme.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's why LeBron, even though LeBron and Kyrie, you know, didn't really see eye to eye, kind of conflicted, they worked well together. They made it happen because they can see, it's just though they can see things. With basketball, when you have those rare geniuses,
yeah,
they can see things way the game is going in slow motion to them. And to me, you need another player like that with LA. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Westbrook, man, he's a beast. He's a relentless just dog. You know, no one's gonna work harder. But it's going to come to a point to where you have to be smarter.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Him and Carmelo, and it's gonna be a hit, a big hit or a big bust. So I'm definitely excited to check them out. Even though I'm a Pistons fan,
Lakers fan, and I'm the ultimate Lakers fan.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Candy or popcorn at the movies?
I'm gonna have to say it both. I like. I'm a sweet and salty combination type of guy.
Hey, that's what's up. Waffles, pancakes, or French toast?
French toast.
Wow, have you ever had French toast with challah?
Challah bread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, you're the first to have said yes. That's interesting. Toughest player you ever played against?
Alonzo Mourning.
Oh, another Hoya. Toughest player you ever practiced against?
Ben Wallace.
Oh my gosh. Those are two great answers. Best advice a player ever gave you?
It's not what you do to get your contract. It's what you do after you get it.
For the next one.
Yeah.
For sure.
Rod Strickland.
Wow. Interesting. He was a great little point guard people don't know about. He could ball. He had mad handles. 50 Cent, Eminem, or Nas?
Nas.
Of course. Drake, Snoop Dogg, or Tupac?
Snoop.
Wow. That's the first time that's been answered that way. Snoop or Kanye?
Snoop.
Wow. Snoop or Jay-Z?
Snoop.
That's classic. Wow. KRS-One, Eric, or Eric B. and Rakim?
Eric B. and Rakim.
Oh, man. Let the rhythm hit him. Let's go. Ice-T, Two Live Crew, or NWA?
NWA.
Let's go. Big Daddy Kane, Public Enemy, or LL?
Big Daddy.
Yeah, Big Daddy was smooth, man.
Smooth, man.
He was smooth, man.
He was smooth. Like, you got to go. When you're young, when Big Daddy was out, when you're young, you want to go to the guys you kind of want to be.
Yeah.
I want to be Big Daddy.
Oh, he was smooth, boy.
Yeah.
Run DMC or Fat Boys?
Run DMC.
Morgan Freeman or Denzel?
Denzel.
AI or Isaiah?
AI.
Wow. Eddie Murphy or Richard Pryor?
Eddie.
Okay, so you're from St. Louis. A couple St. Louis choices here. Albert Pujols or Ozzie Smith?
Ozzie Smith.
Man, I miss those flips.
Yeah.
Jason Tatum or Bradley Beal? Both St. Louis Chaminade products.
Yeah.
They
both incredible players. Man. You know what? It's got to take both of those guys.
Don't you got to lean towards Bradley since he played for the Wizards?
I only lean toward Bradley just because he's the big brother.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So he's a big brother and he done a great job with the little brother, you know. So you kind of for the better the big brother gets, the better the little brother gets. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
But I went to school with Jason Tatum's father, Cardinal.
Wow.
You know, that's like family too. So you know, I just both of them are just amazing to me.
Yeah, they are for sure. Wow, I didn't know that. That's so cool.
Those are two of the best players ever came out of St. Louis right now. You know,
for sure. Yeah.
No comparison.
Would you love more, the 99 greatest show on turf with Kurt Warner or Bob Pettit leading the St. Louis Hawks to the 58 NBA title over the Celtics by scoring 50 in the game 6 clincher?
Greatest show.
Yeah, man, they were something.
Greatest show, man.
Isaac Bruce, man.
Isaac Bruce, Marshall Faulk.
Oh.
Man, come on.
Trying to get Marshall on the show.
Orlando Pace.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Don't forget about Orlando. Best place to get some grub in St. Louis at 2 a.m.
Gingham's.
Was it a burger joint? What is it?
No, it's like a diner.
Oh, nice. Dave Chappelle, yeah. Kevin Hart, Chris Rock. Not thinking about him. He just had COVID. Which one of those three?
It's between
Chappelle, Hart, or Chris Rock.
It's between Chappelle and Rock.
Mm.
I like Chappelle, but Chris Rock to me makes me think more.
That's true.
Yeah,
he definitely does. Inside the NBA, Chuck, Kenny, Shaq, or Ernie?
Chuck.
How impressed are you with Carmelo Anthony's reinventing himself the last couple years?
That's Carmelo's story is one to be just laminated and put it up in the rafters of the NBA Hall of Fame. Just a guy who just, you know, just never quits. You know, his piece, no guy persevered like Carmelo. No guy wants it like Carmelo, you know, and no guy, you know, kind of really did a 180, you know, into the man he is today, like Carmelo. You know,
he also feels bad about him not standing up more for social injustice, and he's talked about that. So I think he's got a lot of reasons to be motivated to stay on the stage, to speak out, and to show that he's still got game. I hope he gets a ring.
Yeah, I do too. And Carmelo, and I understand what he's saying, but you listen.
I mean, hindsight's 20/20.
Think about how many guys got their head chopped off for doing it.
Yeah, I know.
Right? You, the only guy who could really do it is LeBron. He had to lead the way. The only guy who could have done it back then, he probably didn't realize he could have, was MJ.
Yeah.
You know? Only guy who could have did it in boxing was Muhammad Ali.
That's true. You know? I didn't think of it that way. Yeah.
So the only guy who could probably did it in football back then was the guy from East St. Louis that played for Cleveland Browns.
Jim Brown.
Those organizations, you have to be their dependent guy. Like, they depend on you to be the face of the entire not the, just your franchise, but the entire organization.
Or the league.
Now there's some leverage there. Right. Right. Otherwise, you're going to, you know, we've seen the Craig Hodges and the Abdul Raouls, you know, mm-hmm. and that's so I don't think he should feel as bad as he does about it.
Yeah, I understand why he feels the way he does, though, especially looking back on it.
You know, and he got a lot of time to do it now.
No, he does.
And he's been doing a lot of good work.
No, he is. He's a wonderful person, and he's about to pass Danny Shays as the all-time Syracuse leader in seasons in the NBA, so that's pretty cool, great. Too. All right, last two questions real quick. If you had five people at your dinner table, past or present, sports or not, what five people are at your dinner table?
Oh, Muhammad Ali, Barack Obama, Nelson Mandela, Sade. hey.
Let's go. One seat left. Wow.
How many I have left?
You got Obama, you got Sade,
Muhammad Ali,
Nelson Mandela. And Nelson Mandela. So that's four. You got one more.
That's tough.
Hmm.
Malcolm X.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm hoping to get Jeff Pope on the show. He hosts a Malcolm X room on Clubhouse. Just had a conversation with him yesterday, and a very interesting guy, played in the NFL from Detroit. So I'll let you know if he comes on. It should be some very interesting conversations with him. So last question, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Where I see myself in 5 years? Sitting back, drink some red wine.
There you go. Work's overrated.
Sitting back, drinking some red wine, free as a bird, and watching my kids just be happy doing whatever they wanted to do as an adult. You know, if that's sports, if that's business, you know.
Any athletes in the family?
Yeah, all three play basketball.
Oh, wow.
So, they all play for EYBL. Well, two play for the EYBL organization. Then my oldest played for Adidas Gauntlet organization.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Yeah, that's cool. We'll see where it goes, I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, any last words? We didn't talk too much about mental health, and that's definitely something that I always like to touch on. I don't know if you want to say anything about that. And I know you play with Victor Page. That's a tough situation. You know, a lot of the players have come out in the NBA and talked about things, from Kevin to DeMar. So any last thoughts on that? It's not as
tough. If I had any last thoughts concerning mental health, I think that the NBA should really, really put their arms around Ron Artest and make him realize how much he was a pioneer and how much he was the first person to really bring awareness to mental health in a time that everybody else really thought he was crazy. And, you know, if it wasn't for Ron Artest, you know, I think he was the first person who was just open and talked about it and blazed a trail with it. And they need to really create something for him, some type of Ron Artest scholarship or organization, mental health type of thing, a facility called the Ron Artest Mental Health Program facility. Because
an education.
Yeah, because the players. Right. Because, I mean, you're going to always hear about the mouse in the palace.
Right.
But you don't hear about how much he tried to advocate for mental health and everything his struggles and how far he still made it, got a ring and still really fought hard to keep his soul together in those times, you know, his mind, you know, and I think that he really was the first person to actually bring any awareness to it. Like, he the first person that really kind of like sparked the light.
Right.
I don't think he gets enough credit. And I don't think the NBA gives him enough credit.
You know what? Since you said that, I'll probably be using his name a little bit more instead of the Kevin Loves and DeMar DeRozans and Asia Wilsons, because they're important. But you're right. He, first of all, the whole Malice in the Palace thing, the narrative was wrong. And, you know, he definitely deserves more credit. And to the point about everything going on in society, if you don't use something and learn from it and change policies or change education, then what's the point of talking about it?
Right.
So, hey, you spent a lot of time with us. Much love and respect. Appreciate you and what you're doing, what you did, and how you're impacting people now. And truly an honor to share space with you. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate being on. All right, take
all
care.
Right. All right, talk soon. All right.
All right, no doubt.
Yeah, peace. Man, we can't thank Jihadi White enough for joining us here today in the Sports Deli podcast. Fascinating conversation. And, you know, I never really thought about the angle that he talked about last. I hope you stuck around long enough to hear that last segment, because Ron Artest definitely has shed such a big light, and he doesn't get enough credit, and hopefully he gets more credit down the road. And I hope the NBA, you know, does do more in terms of educating young players and screening young players and veterans in a way where they can be better versions of themselves and understand themselves better so that they can transition out of the NBA, especially when they're finished, in a way where, you know, they're of sound mind, body, and spirit, and that those resources are available to them after they leave the NBA or the NFL or Major League Baseball or any other sport that we're talking about. So much respect to Jihadi White for being very candid about a number of different things, from Stephen A. Smith, the role of the media, to his experiences with Big John and the impact that he had on his life. Ah, just unbelievable. Such a big loss. We lost so many coaches this year. Talked about John Shaney. We lost him, and Lute Olson and Big John, and then so many others were lost this year. So we hope you enjoyed this podcast with Jihadi White, former Georgetown Hoya, former NBA veteran. And for Dr. J and Coach K, I'm Hootie Hoot. Please talk to your local politicians about any injustices you feel are taking place, whether it's people that are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses, especially in the spaces of marijuana. And there's a number of cases still out there. Justice for Julius, if you haven't checked that out, check that out online. It's up to the governor right now to exonerate him after being on death row for something that he did not do for the last 20 plus years. And remember, your voice matters when standing up to bullies, social injustice, Asian hate, and be a voice for the voiceless, and then help them find their voice, which is there, but sometimes they just don't know it. Treat your body right and your mind right. Do something for yourself every day. And remember, you are what you eat. Until next time, Black Lives Matter, stop the Asian hate, and remember, it takes a village. Much love to everybody. Peace.